The Major League trade deadline is here, and we are here to break it all down. JJ Cooper, my name is Jacob Rudner, and a big day with lots to talk about across the baseball landscape. Plenty of action to discuss. JJ, how you doing? What are some overall thoughts from this crazy day as we try and catch ourselves up?
Whew. I mean, it's not even done yet. We know that, right? We know that, like, there are moves that have happened that we don't even know what they are yet. That always happens every year. We'll probably hear the last one. I've got social media up. You're going to see my eyes darting over there kind of regularly, trying to see, kind of what some of these moves are, what's happening and all that. But I mean, I think that the teams that jump out, I mean, we got to talk about the Padres. You know, by the way, if you have questions, if you have thoughts, if you have, things that you want to share or want us to talk about, please share it in the comments and we'll get to them. But we've got to talk about the Padres because obviously we talked earlier today about Leo DeVries, biggest prospect to be traded at the deadline in many years. You know, you were I was kind of in the same, you know, I was kind of at BA, you know, but you were a wee lad when Eloy Jimenez was traded to Addison Russell, who's been out of the majors for many a year now. So we had that, but then I love that trade, as we talked about, is controversial, not just because of what they gave up, but it's for a closer. This second trade, where they did trade six players, I believe it was, but getting Ryan O'Hearn and Ramon Laureano, who fix real clear, glaring problems for them. And then to go out, and we don't even know the return yet, but Nestor Cortez. Oh, no, we do know the return. Nestor Cortez for Brandon Lockridge. I think that the Padres have done a lot to fix kind of some of their problems, and they now have the biggest, baddest bullpen that we're ever going to see. What has jumped out to you today?
Well, I think that the Padres-A's trade that sent Mason Miller and J.P. Sears just sticks out to me like a sore thumb relative to the rest of them. And that's actually where I want to start with you, J.J. That is, to me, the biggest trade of this deadline so far. Mason Miller, J.P. Sears go to the Padres in exchange for DeVries, who you just mentioned, Braden Nett, Edwardiel Nunez, and Henry Baez. I'm a little confused about this one, though, and I'm curious what your thoughts are. To me, this seems like a ton to give up for a reliever, albeit a very good one. Mason Miller, one of the best closers in the game right now, and somebody who has lots of team control left. But the reality is, to part with a top prospect for that position is rare. And so I'm curious what you think about that decision, and where do the Padres net out on this one? Is this a win for them?
The thing that we talked about earlier today that I think is really true with this is a lot of it depends on Mason Miller's had elbow issues at times. That's why he's no longer a starter. If they convert him back to a starter and he becomes a star starter, well, then I don't care at that point. It does not matter what Leo DeVries does. Doesn't matter at all. At the same time, if he's a good reliever, but one who over the next 3 years, you know, misses a year plus at some point, all that, well, that would be a very high price to pay for that. And if you try to make him a starter and he gets hurt as a starter, and then you have to figure out that you missed time, significant time that way, and then he's a reliever when he comes back, or, you know, has to figure out if he can still start, that there's a lot of risks there. But while there is risk there, that has never been something that has ever seemed to worry AJ Preller, who I will say with this, like the jokes are like, oh, they don't have a farm system left or anything like that. You can always make trades. There is never a point, there's never a point where you ever get to where you say, oh, sorry, you can't make any trades. You do not have any players that anyone has any interest in. Some of the prospects who went back in this Ramon Laureano, Ryan O'Hearn deal, they're org players. You know, maybe wrong. Maybe what we've gotten on them is completely wrong. But when you're talking about 15 rounders from Harvard last year who are pitching in low A, who had 9 ERAs at Harvard and walked more batters than innings pitched, and then this year have gotten better, but are still getting hit in the Arizona Complex League, you're not talking about, you know, with a high 90s fastball, I should know, but you're not talking about slam dunk, you know, these guys are going to be big leaguers type guys. So prospect, that the thing that is always true about this is that teams are very, very willing to trade players at the deadline, partly to get back prospects, but in a lot of cases also just to get out from under the money. And that's one also, like, I mean, I know we're going to go fast with this because there's so many teams to cover, but I think that what the Twins and Astros did today, I don't want to get that get lost, because if you'd have said a week ago even that Carlos Correa would no longer be a Twin, I mean, the Twins came out of the All-Star break and it kind of was that question of the schedule seems like it's lined up for them to kind of make a little run here. Can they still be in it? They were playing like the Rockies. They were playing like the dregs of every division. And they kept getting pounded by the dregs of every division. So they're out of it. But here you look at it now. Oh, it looks like Griffin Jacks to the Rays, speaking of. Like that. Here you have a team that is Griffin Jacks, Juan Duran. You know, we haven't seen Joe Ryan get traded. But Carlos Correa. I mean, the big thing with Correa is that's if they do get out from under that contract, this is now a complete rebuild, a complete reset. We don't know exactly how much money the Astros are taking back, but that's a significant deal for both teams there. You know, again, there are so many teams that it has been a truly, I would say, wild and very enjoyable last 2 days of the trade deadline, you know, to me at least. I don't know about for you.
No, it certainly has. And before we move on to any of these other trades, I have one more question for you that I think people are wondering. We've heard a lot throughout the day today about how the Padres could end up trading Dylan Cease. If they trade him, what does that make for this deal for Mason Miller? I mean, would that change your perspective?
I'm not going to react to that unless it happens. I'm going to do that. I don't think they're going to trade him. I don't think we need to go down in hypotheticals when we have all these trades to analyze, because I don't know what it means, because I think it would be stupid to do it, but I don't think they're going to do it. Now, it doesn't mean they won't, but I'm saying, like, until we see it happen, I don't think it's going to happen. By the way, just trying to catch up with everything here. So we got Griffin Jacks to the Rays. We got Charlie Morton to the Tigers. Camilo Duvall to the Yankees. Taylor Rogers to the Cubs. That Pirates Taylor Rogers career. Epic in its 24 hours. Phil Maton to the Rangers, Dustin May to the Red Sox, Luis Farland to the Blue Jays as well. The Twins not only traded their closer, they traded their closer, their guy who would step up to be the closer once they traded the closer, and their guy to be the closer once they traded their closer and the backup to the closer, and Bailey Falter to the Royals. Wow.
Let's talk about that. Yoan Duran is the next trade I want to discuss. He goes to the Phillies having an excellent season, 2.01 ERA over 49 in the third innings with 53 strikeouts. He's got excellent stuff. What does that trade do for you? What does that do for the Phillies?
I love it for the Phillies. Now, I mean, they did trade. Eduardo Tait is our number 50 prospect. Mick Abel is a guy who was right on the edge of the 100, right? Those are good prospects they gave back. But Duran's not just one of the best closers in the game, but the thing that he's also done is he does this year in, year out, right? Like, durability is never a guarantee with relief pitchers. Like, they kind of run hot and cold. Yoan Duran, since the day he's arrived in the big leagues, has run hot. Like, his bad months are very good. He's given up one home run all year this year. He just makes them better. And then I'll throw in, though, so then they also added Harrison Bader, who I think is the perfect kind of low-cost addition for them, because if you've watched Phillies games this year, they have a lot of really kind of almost zeros in the outfield. Like, Max Kepler has given them nothing. Anytime, you know, they have they're not getting a whole lot of offensive production, but they've also been bad defensively out there as well. Bader, I don't want to make it sound like Bader is a star, but Bader's really good defensively, and he's hitting at a level that, again, he doesn't have to be great. It's the same thing of like when Cedric Mullins is not having a great year, but when you compare it to Tyrone Taylor's year, looks really good for the Mets. You know, that's where it's like the thing that jumps out to me about all of this is we ended up, for all this talk of So many teams are in it. No one's selling, all that. We got a lot of clarity in the last couple of weeks where all of a sudden a whole lot of teams were selling. And once that happened, it does seem like it feels like that we've kind of opened up the, oh, wow, Taj Bradley for Griffin Jacks.
We'll talk about that. Let's okay. Just jump right on that one.
That's the kind of move that, okay, so let's start from the Rays perspective. Bradley was a top prospect for them, has had moments of success, but obviously was struggling this year, has never really taken that step further step forward. Maybe he still does. Maybe he does in Minnesota. However, if the Rays look at it and say not just this year they're in it, but the Rays are trying to be in it for multiple years, too, if that's the case, then you are looking at that Jax gives you, again, valuable relief work for multiple years. And it's the Rays. I mean, who knows? Maybe they'll do something crazy. When we talk about Mason Miller as a starter, maybe Griffin Jax ends up being a starter down the road or something. Who knows? Fascinating trade right there.
I want to circle back to our NL East conversation. You were talking about the Phillies and the day that they had with an underrated deal for Bader, an impressive one for Duran. The Mets, however, are another team that stand out to me as, a group that had a really good day. The race for that division got a whole lot more interesting on deadline day to me, JJ. What did you see from the Mets that stood out to you with a couple deals? I thought all of them pretty good, though.
Traded 10 prospects. But I would say of those 10 prospects, Jesus Baez is the only top 10 prospect they traded. They did not trade Nolan McLean. They did not trade Jonah Tong. They did not trade Jet Williams. They did not trade Carson Bench. They, at least so far, the dust is still clearing. But they held on to their best prospects. The thing that really stands out to me, talking about it from the prospect side first, we've talked about it some at BA, maybe not enough, but what the Mets have done under David Stearns as far as really ramping up their pitching development and their, when I say pitching development in the minor leagues, I mean on the player personnel side, where what you're doing here is you're taking players and you're making them better, right? That kind of jumps out here today. Again, not all of these. Blake Tidwell was a high pick, right? But when you look at Nate Doan or Frank Ellisalt or Anthony Nunez, Chandler Marsh, Ramon Gomez throws really hard. He's been around for a while and he's thrown hard before. But those are, a lot of cases, those are kind of interesting arms, but they're low cost of acquisition arms who then they've been turned around and turned into big leaguers. And so that's what a really well-functioning farm system does. I know, circling it back to the Padres for a minute, that's what the Padres know. AJ Preller knows this is an ever, and by the way, Chris Kemp and all the many people who work there for the Padres who work really hard with the draft and international and all know, prospects are a renewable resource. The great thing about it is every year there's another draft. Every year there's another international signing day. So, deadline where even if you strip it down, this is not a forest where if you cut down the forest, you're going to have to wait 30 years to have a forest again for the, for the trees to grow. This is something where every time they do it and people say, how are they going to keep doing it? They've been doing it this way now for what? 6 years? 5 years? And it keeps happening. When I look at it from the Mets standpoint, I do think that the Mets have, much like the Phillies, have made themselves a lot better. On the margins, I don't want to make it sound like that they've acquired that, front of the rotation ace who's going to win, four playoff games or something like that. But the way that they have fixed holes, and I would say that center field was a hole, and again, fixed their... Cedric Mullins is good. He's not great, but fixed by that, they've improved there. The bullpen is clearly better. And the other thing I would say about that we're seeing with a lot of these bullpens is what you really want at this point to me is if you're a playoff contender, you don't ever want there to be a day where you're like, we're just going to put out there the relievers who suck, who we're just basically going to forfeit this game. you should now, enough relievers are available at the deadline at very low cost that you can say, okay, we're going to go into the postseason with reasonable and legitimate pitchers to pitch the fifth, the sixth, the seventh, you know, the eighth, and on from there.
Well, I mean, I look at a deal like the one that they made for Gregory Soto, and I think that they did pretty well for themselves. That looks like an underrated deal to me. Wellington Arcena and Cameron Foster in exchange for Soto. Is that the kind of deal that makes teams better when it comes to trading for relievers? Like, what are the margins that you've noticed trend-wise over the years where you're extracting the most value for a relief pitcher? Like, what is the best relief pitcher trade look like to you?
It's when you pick up, I mean, again, most of the time, and I'm sitting here, I should call up my, I don't have every player they're traded for here, but I do have a list of every prospect traded at the deadline. I mean, okay, the answer to your question is Yordan Alvarez for Josh Fields. That's your answer, right? That is it does not get better than you trade a sixth, seventh inning reliever who pitched a few years going forward for a middle of the order bat. That does not happen 99.99999% of the time. But what I would say though is that, I mean, there's a study up at baseballamerica.com right now where you can look at it, where we look at like, okay, what are you hoping to get out of these, right? And I would say that most of these reliever cases, you're talking about, you're getting generally if it's not an elite reliever, the Sotos of the world are not elite relievers. Soto has been kind of passed around from team to team, from year to year. Usually that's going to be a prospect that I would describe as a 600 plus prospect in all of the game, right? So that means a fringe of the top 20 in an organization prospect or beyond that. Since 2015, you're looking at between if it's a really fringe prospect, you're looking at about a 4% chance of getting a 3+ WAR player. And if you look at 600, the best of that range, you are then looking at about a 7% chance at a 3+ WAR player. So that's not great odds when you say 7%. So if you think about it, if there are 13 of these trades, someone's going to get one 3+ WAR player out of one of those 13 trades. You know, players traded. It's not great odds, but at the same time, it does mean, you know, that was Adam Duvall, Yordan Alvarez, where players were traded in that range. Like Pablo Lopez was a low-level prospect included in a trade. So there are examples where it does hit. It's just not all that often.
You wrote a story that I thought was really interesting over on the site that I would encourage people to go check out over at baseballamerica.com. about whether it's better to trade for pitching or hitting prospects at the deadline. Why don't you explain to people what you found in your research there?
I would thought going in that the answer would be the way that it would be distributed would be hitters were way more successful when you traded for them. But then there were these every now and then you hit, like we talked about, the Pablo Lopez's, the Joe Ryans of the world, where every now and then you would have this, like that, the hit rate for hitters would be much higher. And then the best pitchers, though, would be really good. And actually, it's much closer than I thought, right? It's something where, and we looked at it, we tried to look at this kind of a number of ways. Like, so the pure simplest way is you can say, okay, did you reach the majors, right? Did you have one plate appearance or one inning pitched? So I guess theoretically, if you came out there as a pitcher and you didn't get an out, we're not counting you. You had three outs. We need three outs, one plate appearance. Of all the we have 589 prospects that we tracked that were traded at the deadline 2015 to 2024. Obviously, some of these, this number will go up because there are 2024 prospects who were traded who haven't reached the majors yet, but will. But of that group, 57% of hitters have reached majors, one plate appearance, and 58.5% of pitchers. And that number didn't surprise me. It's easier to make it as a pitcher. You come up in to fill, you know, bullpen role for a week, and then you go back down. 100 plus PAs, 46%. Now that's higher than I thought, right? So of all the hitting prospects traded at the deadline, almost one out of every two gets to 100 big league plate appearances. That's a higher success rate than I expected. 50 innings, 35%, 36%, 35.5. Again, higher than I expected, because we're tracking right now. We're not done. And we're at like 65 prospects who were traded at the deadline. If you told me that of those 65, okay, so, you know, probably 65, so probably 35 of those are pitchers. If you told me there are 35 pitchers and I need to find one out of every three of those 35 pitchers, so 11 of those pitchers are going to pitch 50-plus innings in the big leagues, that's a higher number than I would expect. 500 plate appearances. Okay, so if you have 500 plate appearances in the big leagues, I would say that you stuck around, right? You didn't just – this wasn't an hour. This was you had effectively a season over the course. Maybe it was 1 year. Maybe it was over the course of multiple seasons. 26%, more than one out of every four. And then 100 innings, which again, if you throw 100 innings in the big leagues, you had some success at some point. No one gets to throw 100 innings with a 10 ERA. 28% reached that, which is a higher number than the 500 PAs. And you could argue, is 100 innings the equivalent of 500 PAs, whatever. But in both cases, more than one out of every four players. So the way I would put that is, and then I did this with WAR also. And so one plus WAR, 18% of hitters, 17% of pitchers. Five plus WAR, 7% of hitters, 6% of pitchers. And then 10 plus WAR, 2.8% of hitters, 4% of pitchers. Those numbers will go up. Oh, and we've got a new addition coming in.
Here when you need me.
You know, but welcome to the, what is a crazy trade deadline.
Yeah, it's been far more active than last year. And, you know, certainly some big surprises. I don't think necessarily in terms of the MLB players that were moved, maybe the lack of, like, I thought there were a few more guys toward the end of the deadline. I thought the Pirates and some of these teams would maybe, you know, trade a few more of these players that they had, you know, on expiring contracts that could help teams. But, you know, I think the big story is obviously like DeVries moving that we potted on earlier. And, you know, some of the other prospects, so a lot of quality prospects and players, I think, in that we kind of talk about that tier of like 75 to 150, maybe out even into like the 200 range. A lot of those guys moved.
I just want to interject for a second here. So apparently the Doval trade, it looks like it's Jesus Rodriguez, Parks Harbor, Tristan Veerling, and Carlos De La Rosa. We update our top 30s after the trade deadline. Josh Norris, who does our Yankees list, is getting screwed in a way that no one I can ever remember getting screwed. Because if by my count, if those four, so that would get us to 15 Yankees prospects who have been traded at the deadline. And when I say 15, okay, Brown, Martinez, and Josh Groves were not in their top 30. So, okay, we're down to 13. But not every one of these is a top 30 prospect, but most of them are. Most of them are.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. I mean, wow. And again, by the way, I say that. I do the Padres list for us midseason. And, yeah. I mean, to give an example, okay, like I'm glad we added him, right? But so one of the players that the Padres traded in the, and we do mean mammoth, you know, mammoth trade with the Orioles today was Victor Figueroa. We added him to the 30 in June. I'm glad we did, right? He was an interesting addition. Son of the late Jonathan Figueroa, Dodgers prospect, was our number one Dodgers prospect at one point. And then, you know, unfortunately died, you know, very early, you know, way too early because of illness. But Victor's interesting because he hits, but he's massive and he doesn't really have a defensive position. That was 29 on their list before. The guys who are around him on that list are probably going to be somewhere around 17, 18, 19 going forward. Yeah, we've got to find 10 more. It's going to be
fun. All right, let's catch up on a couple things that have happened since we last updated the people. The Royals are acquiring Mike Yastrzemski. That has just come out. And then also the Brewers are going to acquire Shelby Miller. So we have a couple more trades trickling in here as the deadline passes. Yes, JJ?
I will say with the Royals, again, one of the things that jumps out to me about this at the deadline is there are positions that are easily fixable at relatively low cost. Those are ideally what you want, right? If you need a front of the rotation starter, if you need a shortstop, those are going to cost, or I will say one addendum, or in the case of the Astros, if you're willing to take on the majority of a $100 million remaining contract for a 30-year-old with foot issues, okay, that's an exception to that. But those positions are expensive. Closers, expensive. Outfielders and corner infielders, generally pretty inexpensive. The Royals have been so bad in the outfield this year that it is nice to see them kind of make these moves, make these additions that should make an impact. And by the way, I just want to also say with that, I think this gets lost at this time. I think we could talk about it. See Jeremy Hillstrom's "How about them Twins" comment. Fan bases do like what they think, what they take out of something does matter. If I'm a Royals fan, they just re-signed Seth Lugo. So you kept one of your best, you didn't trade him. You just kept one of your best pitchers who, by the way, wanted to stay with you. And you've gone for it at a time where in your division, the Twins and to some extent the Guardians, who kind of been half in, half out, but if you trade Shane Bieber, I don't think you're trading Shane Bieber because you think you're really in it. They stay in it. Like if I'm a Royals fan, the cost of these additions has been pretty modest. Freddie Fermin moves on. Okay, well, that's Carter Jensen. Come on down before long. The cost has been modest. And if I'm a fan, you're trying. If I'm a fan, I want to see a team try. So congrats to the Royals on that. Any of those moves jump out to you, Jeff?
No, I think they're just sort of like beat the buzzer and, sort of fill in some gap kind of moves. Neither that move the needle a whole lot.
I want to ask Jeff, you one Jeff, on I this.
Go ahead.
Hold on. I had a question real quick if I could.
Yeah.
James Tibbs goes to the Dodgers. So James Tibbs has been a giant first round pick, traded to the Red Sox for the Dodgers, to the Red Sox endeavors, and now traded to the Dodgers. I'm just going to say, never a good sign for a first-round pick. Colin Moran, many, many years ago, kind of had this path where it was like, we've got him. Now you've got him. Now you've got him.
It's not a bad comp.
I'm not saying it's never happened, but the number of first-rounders who get traded this often, this quickly, it's rarely because teams acquire the first rounder and go, this guy's so much better than we thought he was. I'm not saying that he wasn't acquired in value. Rafael Devers is value, but it does stand out to me that's like, if you see a first rounder traded two times in the first basically year, not a great sign. Sorry, Jacob. Go ahead.
And I think it really kind of puts the focus on, I guess that was the Kyle Harrison trade for the Red Sox too. The fact that they wouldn't flip Tibbs because, May is a rental. He's expiring after this year, right? So, that's not a great sign, certainly for Tibbs. It's kind of funny that he, was acquired by two organizations that we know are fairly model heavy. We'll see what the pathway is with Tibbs, but you know, he was in the Red Sox hitting development, and I think people kind of thought that might add some impact, and they were quick to kind of pull the plug on that. So, and they have plenty of prospects to trade, by the way, too. It's not like it's like, well, they had to trade Tibbs because otherwise they didn't have any other options. They had a plethora of options. I mean, truly, there were 15 prospects that probably could have gotten that deal done. Maybe you would have had to package some other ones together, but you know, there were a lot of different avenues and pathways. So I think Tibbs getting traded again is kind of remarkable.
Well, we're a half an hour into our live show, and this is a good opportunity to remind you, if you're just joining us, we can and would love to see your comments on what we're talking about. If you have any questions, send them on in. Here's a good one from somebody we know. Carlos Collazo asks us, favorite trade for each of you, non-DeVries edition? JJ, you want to go first?
I'm going to go with, not because I think that Eugenio Suarez is going from a very favorable situation for his hitting to a less favorable situation, as we've seen in the past, because he was a former Mariner. But that said, to add a 30-plus home run bat to the middle of your lineup, and we'll see how much he plays third, because defensively he's not very good, how much they DH him, how are they, you know, kind of, but his bat's going to be in the lineup. For a team that had Cal Raleigh hitting 40 homers and no one else who had more than 20, for a team that had five homers from the third baseman all season, and Eugenio Suarez had a three-game stretch where he did that, to do that and you trade a couple of relief prospects, again, good relief prospects, but slam dunk, no chance they're going to be starter relief prospects, and a first baseman who could be the D-backs, Tyler Locklear, could be the D-backs everyday first baseman down the road, but the Mariners made it clear he wasn't going to be theirs because they had a giant need at first base all year this year. Rowdy Tellez was there. They moved on. Donovan Solano and Luke Raley weren't performing. They went out and they traded for Josh Naylor, but Tyler Locklear was sitting in AAA, having reached AAA last year, having played the majors last year. That just seems like a very light return. So if I'm looking at it from Seattle's standpoint, they just fixed first base and third base, or fixed the middle of their lineup around Cal Raleigh, and they did it without giving up any of the top tier, like the Colt Emersons and the Ryan Sloanes and the Michael Arroyos and the Lázaro Montezes and all those guys that we could go to. I love that trade.
Jeff?
Yeah, I think there's like two for me that really stick out. Number one was the Astros acquiring Jesus Sanchez. I think this is a great get for them. When you kind of dig under the hood on Sanchez, you know, the bat to ball skills are really good. There was a significant step forward this year in terms of the swing decisions. He's really not expanding the zone like he had previously and kind of swinging himself into outs. I think you then look at the power this guy has, kind of easy plus to maybe almost plus raw power. The angles are kind of flat. I think that's pretty fixable. He's not a great defender at all, but can play, you know, a couple of spots in the corner outfield, which is something the Astros desperately need. And he's going from one of the worst, if not the worst, home park in Major League Baseball to going to a park that, you know, plays much better for power. You know, he's a left-handed hitter, so he's not going to necessarily benefit from the Crawford boxes if he's pulling balls. But at the same time, the fences are really, really shallow. And not very high, you know, out in right field. So I think when you kind of look at a player like that, there's still a couple of years control in 26 and 27 after this. I think that's a really good deal for the Astros and a piece that you can kind of pencil into their lineup for a couple of years. So I think to, you know, acquire him for your sort of swingman reliever, you know, a defense first prospect that, if you squint your eyes and are really hopeful, you can be like, oh, he'll be a really good utility man. But even then, I'm not so sure that's the case with Chase Jaworski, and probably an org guy with gaudy steal numbers in Esmiel Valencia. So you didn't give up a whole lot, and you traded really nothing from your top 10 at all, even your top 20, based on how I do that list. And you were able to acquire a pretty good player that I think has a lot of upside. The other trade I'll call out is, I think trading Shane Bieber and getting back Cal Stevens straight up is a great deal for the Guardians. I've heard some conversation that, you know, you could even rank Steven as their best pitching prospect right now. I think that's true. He's still pretty projectable with really good stuff. There's a ton of pitchability there. He's already up in the upper minors. I think he's a guy you can pencil into the rotation, maybe later in the season in 26, but doesn't have a whole lot more sort of seasoning that's needed for him to be a major league caliber starter. So I think that's a really good get when you consider the fact that Bieber has not thrown a pitch in the major leagues this year, really hasn't pitched in the majors since the beginning of April, you know, of 2024. He's still recovering from Tommy John surgery, did have one shutdown in June when he was supposed to come back, you know, after his first rehab start in late May, has now gone a little bit further in the rehab process, looks like he's ready to return. But at the same time, you're kind of gambling on him pitching well enough to help you, but not pitching well enough that he opts out next year at $16 million. That's kind of the best case scenario for the Blue Jays. And you sort of then have to take a step back and be like, don't you want the guy that you acquired to pitch as well as he possibly can? There's obviously some risk, but $16 million is still pretty cheap. If Bieber, you know, goes on a run here, and I know the Blue Jays certainly want to make a deep playoff run and have a good chance of winning this division. If that's the case and, you know, he's pitching in big moments in the ALCS and does well, he's definitely going to free agency. So there's a lot of risk, I think, with that trade, considering Cal Steven was one of their better prospects, you know, was number five in that system. And I think you could argue maybe even as high as three.
One of the best prospects traded at the deadline.
Yeah.
Before we keep going down the list here, some trade deadline adjacent news, if you will. And I want somebody to just break it down real quick for us. Our Jesus Cano can confirm that the A's are calling up Luis Morales to the majors. I'd love for one of you to break that down for us.
I can take it, or Jeff, you're our pitching guru.
Yeah, I think, you know, Morales has always had good stuff. I don't think the numbers have necessarily tracked, like, just in terms of strikeouts and then even performance to kind of what the stuff is. Signed for a big bonus out of Cuba. And I think there's always some rust and some adjustment periods that come along with any players coming over from Cuba, especially when it's a young pitcher like Morales. It has never really been bad. It's really interesting fastball traits, gets ride in the fastball, interesting release traits in the fastball. So the plane is pretty good. And he sits like mid to high 90s. Secondaries haven't developed as much as that. It's always kind of been fastball heavy. But, you know, a guy that's been kind of on and off on the fringes of the top 100 for us.
How many times have we debated him versus Jack Perkins? Like within the organization of like one of these guys is going on, but which one is it going to be?
And then there might be a game in the coming weeks where Luis Morales is the winning pitcher and Jack Perkins closes it out as the closer now that he's replacing Mason Miller. Right. So, I mean, it's kind of funny that, you know, both those guys could be pretty good when we turn around. But yeah, I think Morales at this point does need a little more seasoning, but at the same time, like, would you rather he gets that in Las Vegas in the PCL with those strike zones, with the way the ball travels versus, let's just call him up and he pitches
it's open PCL audition park now.
At home and then get some relief, I guess, when he faces MLB lineups on the road. But I think it's kind of, in terms of, you know, hurting his development, it's kind of, you know, half dozen one way, six the other. So no big deal.
All righty. Good stuff. We're moving on back to trades. A question from Anonymous. According to ESPN, Gore to the Cubs didn't happen because the Nats wanted Shaw. In your opinion, did the Cubs have enough non-Shaw prospect power to offer commensurate value for Gore? JJ, you're first.
I would say they do have enough, but again, there's two things that have to happen here. Like, I get it why they wouldn't include Shaw from the standpoint of like, okay, if we include Shaw, we have to figure out, like, that's actually hurting our big league club in some way. So, okay, is that something you want to do? But I would also say Shaw is a better prospect than pretty much all the guys we're talking about as far as minor league prospects. Like, he plays a premium, you know, relatively premium position in the dirt. Most of the other guys that we're talking about for the Cubs, and I'm going to kick this to Jeff pretty quick because he does our Cubs list, but are either, like, in Ballesteros' case, maybe he catches, but there's still questions there. We just know he can really hit. most of the other top prospects are either, you know, we do have Jackson Wiggins, and we have a lot of outfielders, Owen Casey, we have Kevin Alcantara, guys like that, where I'm not saying like you could put a volume of prospects together where it could be enough, maybe, but it gets tougher if you don't have a guy like Shaw. And if I'm the Nationals, I want someone like Shaw in this, where I'm like, okay, I'm getting a guy who's immediately going to be on my big league roster, but is also under team control for the remainder of the decade. That would be, if I'm going to trade Mackenzie Gore, it can't be for guys who I hope are going to help us. You know, again, most Cubs prospects aren't this way, but it can't be for guys who you hope will be arrive in 2028.
What say you, Jeff?
Yeah, you know, I go back and forth on this one because, you know, I could certainly see the case, you know, for acquiring Gore. I think that's a big piece. Certainly moves them toward, you know, their championship window, which I think is this year. I expected them to be a little bit more aggressive than they were at the deadline. I'm shocked that it had to be Shaw because there were enough good pieces, I think, at the top of that Cubs system to get it done. But yeah, at the end of the day, I could see why they didn't want to part with Shaw, because I think the best is still to come with him. And I think if you watch the Cubs enough, you see that, you know, he's a good young developing ball player that, you know, is just learning, you know, game by game. He's doing a lot of little things really well that doesn't necessarily show up in the numbers. And I think he's somebody that, you know, a year or two from now, you know, Cubs fans might be like, you know, phew, thank God we didn't make that trade. But, you know, at the same time, Gore would have put them kind of over the top. And I think that's kind of the big piece that Cubs fans and, you know, probably a lot of players in that team were hoping they'd make to sort of get it done. And, you know,
the Cubs don't feel like they have enough pitching. Their lineup's great, but it does not feel like they have enough pitching for what you're going to need in the postseason.
JJ, yeah. would you chalk them up to being a deadline winner or loser, the Cubs?
Compared to the rest of the teams, I'd say loser, because I would say other teams in the National League got better.
Yeah, I would say that they're a deadline loser. There was no, you know, sort of big impactful trades for them. Getting Willy Castro, I think, was a nice piece. But the funny thing, too, is like adding Willy Castro would have maybe covered you a little bit if you did want to trade Shaw, you know, for Gore. So I think some of the mechanics on something like that didn't take place. Casey doesn't get moved. Alcantara doesn't get moved. Long doesn't get moved. Jackson Wiggins doesn't get moved. Like you have a lot of these players now, and it's sort of like some of these guys at this point, and especially the guys in AAA I named, are kind of rotting on the vine. Alcantara and Casey are going to spend two full years in AAA. It's almost like they're getting the Michael Bush curse now that curse has been freed. And
it's spread. It's contagious.
Yeah, Cubs in Atlanta. It's been spread. Exactly.
They got it in spring training. But by the way, Kevin Alcantara made his big league debut in 2023, and here we are, likely he will end 2025, basically having gotten no further, no closer. I did want to add, we do now have the return in the Carlos Correa trade, and I feel comfortable in saying we do at Baseball America, we rank all the prospects who are traded, and I believe that Matt Mikulski will be whatever number we end up at, number 90, number 88 or whatever. I'm pretty sure that will be that like number 88. That one does feel, nothing against Matt Mikulski, but that feels truly 100%. We're not going to do this for nothing because it would look bad. However, we're really just trading him for your taking the salary.
So what was the return?
Matt Mikulski.
That was it.
That's it.
All right there.
When there was some reporting that the return was going to look underwhelming due to the salary influence in this trade.
Yeah,
it was Chandler Rome. Yeah, who said
all the money.
Right. No, the reporting seems to be that there's like 30 mil that the Twins will, but that still leaves basically 70 mil on the hook for the Astros. Wow. That's still. I think we have some Twins questions here from Jeremy that may be perfect to kind of tie in with this. But Mikulski was released in spring training by the Giants, signed basically 2 months later by the Astros and 2 months after being picked up as a completely available, free, released minor leaguer, he is traded for Carlos Correa straight up.
So there you go.
When your business has an opening that you needed to fill yesterday, there's an easy answer to your problem. How do you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. When it comes to hiring, Indeed is all you need. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. Indeed sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your posts jump to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. For us, Indeed has made hiring easy time after time. We get great candidates who find us on Indeed, and we can do the entire hiring process all within Indeed. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. How fast is Indeed? In the minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed data worldwide. There's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed, and listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Let's jump over to one of those questions from Jeremy about the Twins. I like this one. I suppose I'll ask, given the flurry of moves for my Twins, what do you see as a realistic timeline for contention again? Jeff, we'll go to you first.
In that division, it feels like from year to year, things can fluctuate so greatly. And, you know, I don't think the bones of a bad team are necessarily there. There's some elements where, you know, if they supplement this roster a little bit, the rotation could be a little bit better. I think they got themselves out from a fairly big albatross in Carlos Correa in the waning years of that contract. A big part of this team has always been health. We have prospects that I think if you asked us 2 years ago when we anticipated they would debut in Emmanuel Rodriguez and Walker Jenkins, it would be in this 25 to 26 window when we would have anticipated that those players would graduate and potentially have a lot of impact. And, you know, I think that's kind of been the story even with, you know, their prospects historically, whether it's Buxton, whether it's Royce Lewis, there's just been a lot of guys with a lot of bad injury luck. So how that turns around, we'll see. There's also a lot of, you know, young players like Larnick who took a step forward this year. Brooks Lee has been up and down and inconsistent, but I still think there's something there. There's still some pieces to sort of like, and, you know, they didn't trade away Joe Ryan and, you know, Zebby Matthews and some of these other pieces are also, on this roster. So, you know, they traded away some good relievers and, Carlos Correa, who I think in name is a big trade, but, you know, is a pretty big W when you consider how much money you potentially freed up, you know, for free agency the next couple of years. And who knows if they make another big splash, but I think the potential there, especially in this division, to kind of make a jump next year with, you know, Cleveland also selling. I don't think that would be outrageous.
So I'd start with, it's a good question to ask, Jeremy. Thank you for the question. But I think we realized this year that their realistic timeline for contention with this group seems to be never. I mean, the Carlos Correa deal, basically, I would say two things with it. One, they signed him to this contract, and they did so after the Giants and Mets both were like, we're in. Wait, we looked at the medicals, we're out. And if you look at Correa's now, I guess, 3.5 year career with the Twins, it's a lot of it is tied to health. He's had plantar fasciitis and other issues. He's gone from being a plus runner to being one of the slowest shortstops in baseball. That has affected his range as well. I do kind of like how Jeff put it. Getting out from under that contract, the way that the Twins were operating the way the Twins are operating now salary-wise, which does feel differently than what it was when they signed Carlos Correa, you know, they're trying to be sold, right? Like the way that they've kind of pulled back, they don't really didn't seem like that they had a way to get to success while paying Correa and Byron Buxton. This gets them out from under that. I would say the answer is clearly not. I would say it's very unlikely that they will contend in 26 now, because they're going to have to now completely rebuild that bullpen. They have the guys to do it. We'll see. Like Louis Varland, who they traded, was kind of one of these, I don't know if he can start guys last year, and then he was a really good reliever. I can list, I think, like three or four of those guys on this Twins list. Like, is Zebby Matthews that I don't know if he can start, but he could be a good reliever? Is David Festa going to be the, I don't know if he can start, but he could be a good reliever? They got a number of those guys. But Jeff mentioned the other key thing here. They need Walker Jenkins to be healthy. They need Emmanuel Rodriguez to be healthy. They need Luke Kuechel to be healthy. Yeah, they need Connor Prelip to be healthy. They need Marco Raya to be healthy. You know, you've got all these guys, but they could, like, if it all, like, it never always works out. But if you said mid-2026, this team has Luke Kuechel and Emmanuel Rodriguez and Walker Jenkins and Kalen Culpepper, maybe Kyle DeBarge a little later in the year, all come up. And then you have kind of like Prelip and Raya and, you know, a couple guys like that.
Merrick Houston.
Merrick Houston could be there before too long. If all that happens, it could end up being like, okay, the next time isn't that far away. And it would be a much younger, more athletic team that, which is better than this team that they've had, which has really ended up being kind of flawed. Like,
and I think the other part of like the Twins equation too, is they added Mick Abel, who's already shown that, you know, he can handle some starts in the big leagues. And, you know, pitching in Philly, you know, in that park for that team with the contention window that they're in looking for championships, you know, those are all big starts. And, you know, I think he's a guy that's kind of proved his mettle a little bit, that like, all right, there's a chance that this guy, you know, could be a mid rotation type starter that we thought he was. Twins pitching development too, for, you know, any knocks you want to put on the Twins organization, hasn't been bad. They've been kind of cutting edge. They've had a lot of guys that have been hired out to a lot of other teams, like Justin Willard from the Red Sox, you know, came from the Twins. But I think there's also a lot of guys, when you talk about their starters, maybe relievers, there's maybe a few underrated arms that were kind of lurking within the Twins top 30 as well. And a guy like Andrew Morris, or, you know, CJ Culpepper or Corey Lewis, like all those guys could maybe fit into sort of those kind of roles in the future. And, you know, they had some decent picks. I thought they had a really good draft this year. They were one of my favorite drafts. So overall, they've kind of been an interesting drafting team the last few years. So there's ingredients and pieces here and some depth that, you know, it could kind of come together. And if the window strikes correctly, they'll still have some players potentially in the farm system from which to trade and maybe acquire and upgrade some other positions as needed. So I think they're in a better position today than they were probably, you know, this morning or yesterday, in terms of having like a more recent contention window, because I do think that Correa contract would have really sunk them.
And that Correa contract was $32 million next year and $31 million the year after that and $31 million the year after that. And he's 30 now. They've already had the salad years of this contract. It's, you can't expect that it's going to get better when he's in his 30s.
This may be too harsh for me, but, and you guys can rein me back in if it is, but what separates the Twins' current situation after the day that they had today from the conversation that I recall we were having about the A's coming into this season? Young, promising team, lots of talent. They made some moves that everybody kind of thought was interesting, but they loaded up in a way that looked promising. And now we're talking about an A's team that's selling because they're not terribly competitive. Why are the Twins different, or are they different at all?
They do have a ballpark.
Yeah, that's organizational stability.
They know where they're going to play this year, next year, 4 years from now, 6 years from now. It's a nice ballpark. You know, you could ideally want a roof in April in Minnesota, but, you know, I would say that that's like the overarching part of it is that, like, if you said right now, I actually think that for the A's, to talk about them for a minute, I feel like that for the A's, what they're doing makes a lot of sense. They are like, you've got to give them all kind of credit for Jacob Wilson, Nick Kurtz, back-to-back years. Great on the drafting side, right? Like that is, you have an actual core there. Selling high on a 102 mile an hour throwing reliever. And we say selling high, adding literally the best prospect that the A's have had in their organization in years now. And you get that for a guy who, anytime he takes the mound, that value could really, again, I love Mason Miller. He's a great closer. But if he locks off the mound holding his arm, that value you have for him, not only what you get out of him, but the trade value for him goes way down immediately. And saving games, like this year's started, had that really bad stretch, and they're not as bad as that. But this year, they weren't going to win it. They're not going to win it next year. I would say, like, you can, again, if you're not in the now or next year window with a closure and you can get a truly epic haul for him, that's never a crazy idea in my mind.
I'll just add real quick. Zach Erhard is also headed to the Dodgers in the Dustin May trade. So it's Erhard for May. And who else was involved in that trade? Why am I drawing a blank right now?
Number 29 Red Sox prospect. Okay. Zach Erhard.
Very nice. Let's keep going down the list here. We got a lot more questions, and I'll remind everybody, if you're watching the show right now, we can see your questions and we want to answer them just like we're going to do here. I apologize if I mispronounce your name, but Always Tabish asks us thoughts on what Jays gave up for Dominguez, Bieber, and Varland. We talked a little bit about what that Bieber trade looked like with Cal Steven. JJ, or actually, you know what, Jeff, you do the Blue Jays list for us. What do you think about the departures there before we go to you, JJ?
Yeah. You know, I thought that the price on Bieber being Steven was pretty steep, but you know, I understand what the gamble is. I'd have to look, you know, the Varland details. That trade happened. I was writing up a trade right before I hopped.
I'm looking right now because I do want to see.
I know it was Alan Roden and Kendry Rojas, if I'm not mistaken. So, like, what are the contract details on Varland? Does he have like 4 years?
He's got multiple years. He only came up just to, like, he's not even hit arbitration yet.
Okay. So like, if I understand that,
then. Ty France did that deal too, by the way, in a,
okay. And Ty France. So, I mean,
you could have Ty France in that deal.
They kind of fortified a few positions. I think, you know, I've liked both prospects quite a bit. I think Rojas was almost pushing up to like top 100 status, you know, had his AAA debut, didn't go so hot the other night. But overall, like, projectable lefty, the projection starting to hit, really interesting arm action, like the slider, like the changeup, like it's a true three pitch mix. We get really good feedback from both analysts and scouts on him. I think that was a good pickup. You know, Alan Roden's a good ball player. I think just probably more like a second division regular that needs some runs, some opportunities, some playing time at the big league level.
And we've got good news for you, Alan, because it's wide open in Minnesota right now.
Yeah, definitely like a personal cheese ball of mine. You know, he's a guy that has great approach, good bats of ball skills, kind of enough power. The angles haven't always been great, but he has a very unusual setup. And he's a better athlete than I think people realize. So he's actually pretty good in the corner outfield. And I think a guy that you feel pretty comfortable penciling into the lineup every day. Interesting background as well. Spent 4 years at Creighton and graduated with a degree in aerodynamics, I believe.
There you go. Smart guy. JJ. I'll
note with that, Kendry Rojas.
I'm wrong. It was astrophysics.
Kendry Rojas and Roden are going to rank among the better prospects who are traded at the deadline. Like, I mean, they're not going to be like, we're going to rank 75, 85, 90 prospects who are traded. They're going to be in the top 10, top 15. Like, that's and it should be a legitimate haul because Varland is a good reliever who can be a Blue Jay basically now for the remainder of the 2020s, pretty much. So it's like, it should be a haul. Ty France, I don't think, played a whole big role in that. But yeah, but Kendry Rojas is really interesting.
And they've really fortified that bullpen in Toronto. You know, adding Dominguez, adding Varland, you know, those are big moves in terms of, you know, adding some length to that pen, which we know is super important.
So Anthony Dominguez, you know, is a, yeah, that's, Will Wagner, Brandon Valenzuela, a little bit of a smaller deal too.
Yeah. I think they needed a defensive catcher in the system. you know, I think that was why they made that deal, and Wagner was kind of the odd man out, as was Roden, you know.
That those are the deals on trade deadline day that, again, I have no reporting on this, but just talking to front office officials about what trade deadline day is like on normally, right? So you have your GM or your president of baseball ops and all, and he's over there with his team working on the deals, right? Then there's a subordinate over here working with the subordinate in San Diego, right? Because I sure hope AJ was not on the phone going like, okay, for Valenzuela, Will Wagner. I think we could do Wagner for that. There is a whole separate conversation going on there where two subordinates are able to work on that. Everyone good? Okay, done. Because that trade happened like as the Padres were working out like 8-player deals with the Orioles and probably talking about 11 other deals at the same time. You know, so it is, again, it's always fun to hear about the logistics of how things work on trade deadline day. Most teams can farm those out to someone else, not the GM, to do those because you have to have multiple things going on.
We have more questions and we're going to get back to them in a second. I want to talk about something that hasn't been asked about yet because it's interesting to me. I'm hearing that the Marlins they're done. There's no more secret sneaky deals that are waiting to come through here. They only traded Jesus Sanchez and Nick Fortes. They are going to go for it. And they are a hot team right now. They're 7 games back of the wild card. I'm curious what you guys think about the inaction from Miami, because about 24 hours ago, if we had this conversation, I think all three of us would have sat here and said that Sandy Alcantara was on the way to somewhere else. Anthony Bender was probably headed somewhere else. Cabrera might have been headed somewhere else. And it really ended up being a lot of nothing. Two trades for the Marlins, neither terribly huge impact. JJ first, what do you think about that, about them going for it as opposed to selling this year?
How are they? I mean, again, I don't mind them. A lot of the guys that we're talking about them holding on to are not free agents at the end of the year. So I don't want to criticize them for holding on to guys who they still will have next year. They'll have plenty of opportunities to figure this out. At the same time, when we say like going for it, okay, let's just take the teams that they aren't catching in any scenario in any world, right? The Brewers or Cubs, one of those is going to win the Central, but the other is taking a wild card spot. The Cubs are 63-45 right now in a wild card spot. So that's off the board. So we are now either going to win the East or we're winning one of two wild card spots. Okay. The Phillies in their own division are not winning the division because that's the Mets. By the way, the Mets and Phillies, who both did way more to upgrade much better teams than the Marlins today. So that's the second wild card is off the board. Take it away. You are not going from 52-55 and catching a 61-47 Phillies team. Gene Mock is not managing that team, and they have more than two pitchers that they're going to use down the stretch. Yes, I'm making a reference that is lost on many, many, many people, I know, but that's a fun baseball history, the great collapse. Okay. The Padres are 60-49. We just talked about all these things the Padres did. I don't think that they're going to catch 6 games basically on the Padres. 7, sorry. And then behind them, you have the Reds, who are 57-52 right now and are in it. And again, like, are just a better team. And also
did way more today.
Those moves are great, but made moves, they're going to help them.
Yes. Doesn't really add up. Jeff? Anything?
Yeah, I don't know if I have anything to even add on that. I think you kind of summarized it perfectly. It's I'm a little surprised. I guess there's still a couple years left with Alcantara. And you know, maybe this is a guy where they head into the off season and you know that's the right time to trade him. Kind of gets a little platform period here for the last couple of months to prove that he's fully healthy and kind of has it all together. I'm kind of surprised maybe that, you know, Edward Cabrera didn't get moved. It seems like that would have been a great sell high candidate at this point in time. And
that was rumored until it didn't happen, by the way, I should add.
Yeah, exactly. I would have liked to have seen them add, you know, a little bit more firepower. If that's where something they were looking to do was compete as opposed to kind of subtract a little firepower from the lineup. But yeah, it was an unusual deadline for them. Mike would be more active.
But not enough. Can I lay out this? I do want to point out, Jeff, though. Let me just point out. Okay, they traded Sanchez. This team next year, payroll wise, has Sandy at $17 million, 17.3. Cabrera will be in arbitration. Braxton, Garrett, and Anthony. Well, they traded Bender, right? Didn't they trade Bender?
Yes.
Okay. Braxton Garrett will be arbitration eligible. That ends the list of non-major league, basically assigned salaries on their roster right now. So I don't like, even with Cabrera, Cabrera has two more years, like under team control. So does Sandy. Potentially Sandy has one more year plus an option year. I don't hate it for them that they're like, that they try the rest of the way, that they get to hopefully 81 wins. And then next year with Yuri Perez kind of fully back and everything with this rotation, and maybe, I don't know, this is asking a lot for Miami, but maybe spend a little money to go with it on a payroll that is right now estimated to be 80 million, you know, do that. Like, hey, okay. You know, I think that there's, if the price, if they could not get the price, the same way with the Nationals, right? If you can't get a truly epic haul for these really good players you have, who you are going to have under team control for years to come, don't trade them. Like, don't give them away. If you, now again, if someone wants to back up the truck and says, hey, we look at this, we really do believe this will make us better next year. Okay, that's different. But if you don't get that, keep good players.
Another team that was kind of inactive today, to my surprise, was the Dodgers. I mean, they made a couple of moves, but not the splash that I think many people went into this morning anticipating. Brock Stewart is among the receipts.
We forgot to mention him. So the Twins traded their top four relievers in the last 2 days?
Yes, yes. Brock Stewart with a 2.38 ERA this season off the top of my head. So he's been outstanding and kind of reinvented himself, destroys righties. But, JJ, still not the impressive deadline I expected the Dodgers to have. Were you surprised?
Not stunned. They did have Alex Call as well, who I think actually fits for them reasonably well because Michael Conforto has been really bad.
DFA bad.
I mean, yeah, like it. I know that there was talk like he's had a better month. Yes, but the previous four or three were really bad. But I kind of feel like that this roster is, it's kind of by design almost at this point static. You know, I'm not saying they couldn't make moves, but when you look at how many 40-man roster spots they have filled right now with, like, and how many guys they have on 60-day IL stints who sometime are going to have to come off and all that. I don't feel like that there was a whole lot of room. Like, okay, position player-wise, I kind of feel like this is the team, right? I know they could have gone out and said, okay, you know, but Max Muncy thankfully didn't blow out his knee where he's done for the year. Where were they going to, like, they don't even give Dalton Rushing. Dalton Rushing is on this team, and you can forget, you can have weeks where you forget that he's on this team. It's one of the better catching prospects in baseball, you know. And, you know, they have depth position player-wise, if everyone's reasonably healthy. And on the pitching side, they have so many guys hurt. They did add a little bit, but I do feel like even they have limits where it's like, okay, they're really kind of counting on that how they're going to get there is by having enough of these arms be healthy in October, which is something that admittedly they have gone 0-2 the last 2 years. They managed to make it work, but they've still, like, they almost run out of arms in recent years. And they did. I mean, they really did a couple of years ago where, I would say, like, right now it would be shocking to if Clayton Kershaw started a postseason game for them. That he was starting the game that mattered 2 years ago in a similar state. So I'm not that shocked that they didn't do that much. They do feel like a team that kind of didn't have a whole lot of choice but to be relatively static.
We knew they needed an outfielder, though, and that was part of the conversation leading up to the deadline. I thought they were going to make a bigger splash. But, Jeff, you want to comment on that, or should we move on to some more questions here?
No, I don't think there's necessarily anything to add. I kind of agreed. I anticipated that maybe Stephen Kwan would get moved and that that would be where the landing spot would be, maybe even Louis Robert. Yeah, I expected to be a bigger splash than Alex Call, but apparently Alex Call services were much more in demand than we expected, because that was one of the surprisingly high prospect returns.
I always believed in Alex Call, but that was even high to
maybe they're playing. They're like the multi-time champion guy that beats up your dynasty football league, and that he's got to pay an extra tax in order to acquire good players. Maybe that's what's happening now.
Do remember, though, so the Nationals have turned sneaky moves the last 2 years. Lane Thomas last year and Alex Call this year. These kind of fringe of the third to fourth outfield types, they move them at the deadline.
Let's talk White Sox, gentlemen. We got a White Sox question here. Any opinions on the White Sox holding on to some of the one-year rentals and relief pitchers instead of cashing in on some lotto tickets? Just feel like they could have done more. I personally agree with that. Jeff, do you?
Yeah, they almost feel like the opposite of the Twins, where the Twins were like, hey, we have relievers. You want relievers? We'll trade you relievers. We'll find more relievers. We don't care about relievers. And they collected good assets. You would think the White Sox, who, you know, their competitive window and just kind of how the organization has operated over the last decade, you would anticipate that they would be more aggressive in trying to move some of those pieces. And even with the trading pitching market, what it is, they have some decent young pitchers that have control that might have actually demanded pretty big returns. And that's been kind of the way the White Sox have tried to build, is by they get a player that has some value and then they trade them for better prospects than the ones that they draft. And those guys tend to be the next major leaguers that come up, and the cycle repeats itself. The one that's really puzzling to me is the Louis Robert trade. I don't understand why you would hold on to Robert. I know that there's like this option year next year, and you know, it's $20 million, which I think for a player of his caliber on its surface seems like an okay value. But he never really returns that. And there's probably a chance that they decline that option. He goes to free agency and then they get back the comp pick. I kind of wonder what the market looked like, because there were definitely teams that kicked the tires on that. We haven't heard any, you know, potential offers or players that were dangled the other way. But I would expect that, you know, you probably, based on the way this trade deadline went, you could have gotten at least a couple of decent prospects for him. And that seems like better business, but sometimes, you know, the comp picks, you know, ultimately maybe are of more value. So maybe that's what you're fighting up against a little bit, but the Robert one still did surprise me.
JJ?
I am surprised, but at the same time, I think what it is the returns that they were getting offered were like, we can't trade him for this. Like just partly from a purely PR perspective, this is still a really bad roster. And if Luis Robert kind of nets back for you like a trade package that is worse than Alex Call received, let's just say theoretically, right? Which, considering the salaries and considering the production, is not crazy that it could have been something that low, right? Maybe I'm wrong, but he's really not performed a whole lot and he's paid a lot. And you're really, if you acquired him, you have to give serious thought about whether you're going to exercise that option. After that, they're just, I hear what Morgan's saying here, but a lot of these one-year rentals and relief pitchers haven't been very good this year. And so like, then it becomes really hard. I'm not saying you can't try to move them, but you're really just dumping them at that point. Like if you said who's been their best relief pitcher, I'm proud to say as a card-carrying member of the Rule 5 Forever Club, and Jeff, I see you there, and I know you have your card too, Mike Vassell's been really good, but I don't know how much value there is if you're trying to trade a Rule 5 reliever. Like, you can't even you can't option that dude. You know, you if you acquired him, it'd be like, well, he's up for the rest of the year. I don't care how he looks, or we're gonna have to, you know, accept that we DFA'd our a reliever we acquired. I mean, Tyler Alexander, maybe. I mean, I'm not saying there was no one here, but a lot of these guys, like Bryce Wilson, you know, like they're a lot of the pitchers they've had this year. Steven Wilson, Jordan Leisure, Cam Boozer, Brandon Eisert. I don't think any of these are like, if they get on the phone and they're like, hey, are you interested? It's like, no, not really. No, that he's not going to improve our bullpen. We can do elsewhere. So I think that's the problem they are in here. Now, to their credit, it's starting to pick up. They had a great Rule 5 draft. Can't say that very often, but they truly did. They had a great Rule 5, probably the best Rule 5 draft overall. When you have Vassell and Shane Smith, that's the best one I can think of in a while. Like, you'd have to go back to like Josh Hamilton and Joaquin Soria type, you know, years before that. They've gotten Colson Montgomery up to the big leagues and he's hitting for power. You know, okay, we're not going to mention Andrew Vaughn, who kind of scuffled along for them for forever and then basically goes to Milwaukee and turns into the Andrew Vaughn who was supposed to be when he was drafted. But yeah, I think that the catching, you know, is better now. They've got Cuero, they got Teal up. There's pieces here, but I just don't think that, I think it really, at the end of the day, they just didn't have a whole lot to trade.
Let's keep working down the questions here. Andrew Caldwell asks, why do you think Tyler Rogers netted more for the Giants than Camilo Doval? Let me clarify a couple of things before either of you answer that. The return for Tyler Rogers included two top 15 prospects from the Mets, former teammates from college land, Blade Tidwell and Drew Gilbert, headed over to San Francisco. And then for Camilo Doval, the Yankees parted with Carlos De La Rosa, their number 25 prospect, Jesus Rodriguez, number 29, and then Tristan Vreiling and Parks Harbor, neither of whom were ranked. JJ.
The main reason being is that Tyler Rogers is better than Camilo Doval. He's been that way. Like, Camilo Doval, I know that one is the closer and one has not been the closer.
One is the most underrated reliever in the game, I'd go as far as to say. Go ahead, sorry.
One of them is a really good reliever who has been incredibly durable and reliable, who gives you basically 70-plus appearances a year, can go back-to-back, can go back-to-back-to-back, could go on one day's rest all the time, which is a very important and wonderful addition to a bullpen, to have a guy who you put out there yesterday and you say, can you go today? And he's like, I'm good, Skip. Yeah, give me the ball. And the other is their closer, but is one who last year was really not very good. He's been better this year, but he's more up and down. He's not as consistent. He's not as rubber-armed, which few are. Now, the gap between the two halls is a little bit surprising to me, but I also think part of that is I'll try to say this politely. The two guys, the Blade Tidwell and Drew Gilbert prospects, were very famous. More famous than they are top prospects. And I don't know what we could have done yesterday. We were trying to scream it from the heavens. That's the number 10 and 14 prospects in the Mets system. That is not top five prospects. That is not their best outfield prospect or their second best outfield prospect or their third best outfield prospect. That's not their best pitching prospect or their second best pitching prospect or their third best pitching prospect or their fourth best pitching prospect. The guys they gave up, they had better guys. But that said, I completely agree that the haul they got back is more, but I think that's because Tyler Rogers is just better.
Jeff, anything?
No, I think JJ kind of.
Yeah, you know, we'll just go one. We can ping pong back. We'll raise our hand if we have something else to add, because both of us cover them pretty good.
Then, Jeff, you're up. Have the Pittsburgh Pirates had one of the worst deadlines of all time? Maybe just a very depressed Pirates fan.
Yeah, I don't know all time. That's difficult to say. I think it's certainly disappointing. And I think, like, when you look at the rotation and some of the things that are going on, you would have at least anticipated them at the very least to be like, all right, let's trade away some of these, you know, expiring contracts like NIKF, you know, as potentially somebody would want as a fill-in. Andrew Haney's expiring, Tommy Pham's expiring. None of these are, you know, humongous names. And I think if they really wanted to get creative, right now wouldn't have been such a bad time to maybe listen on O'Neill Cruz. Wouldn't have been a bad time to potentially trade Mitch Keller. Stuff like that could certainly still be explored in the offseason. But, you know, it felt like it was a seller's market and they didn't necessarily take advantage of it with, you know, players that maybe don't fully fit their window for an organization, particularly on the position player side, that could have gained a lot, you know, just in terms of the depth that's needed for them to kind of build a lineup and a competitive team around Paul Skeens and, you know, Bubba Chandler and Jones when he returns, et cetera, in the future. So I think when you look at it from that perspective, it was disappointing. I don't know if it was the worst trade deadline. You know, I think there's been, you know, some teams in years prior that kind of maybe held a little too tight in terms of players that had expiring contracts, thinking they were going to compete. There's some Angels trade deadlines that have been pretty bad in retrospect. So I don't know if I would go that far, but I think moving Keller at the very least would have been, you know, exciting. But a lot of those big name pitchers that we thought that could potentially get moved, Joe Ryan, Mackenzie Gore, all those guys stayed put. So maybe it was just, you know, a buyer's market and sort of that mid tier, but the higher end, the prices just weren't met.
We've talked about the Orioles quite a bit on this show already, but I do want to answer Michael's question here. JJ, he asks, Orioles sold a lot this deadline. Did they get a reasonable return?
I think they got a reasonable return. I think also, to be clear, like, obviously they had the big trade with the Padres, but they had assets to trade, but they didn't have kind of like the slam dunk, oh, this is going to rebuild the team type assets, right? They had guys in a lot of cases, either like Ramon Laureano is having a great year, but Ramon Laureano was also released last year, right? In season. So you're there's a limit to how much you're getting for him, because there is kind of in the back of your head, if you're a team, it's like, yeah, when he went passed on waivers last year, we looked at him and didn't sign him. So, like, there's that. Ryan O'Hearn is a good player, but he's not a great player, and he's coming to the end of his deal. So it's like, okay, they have players like that. Cedric Mullins has been a great Oriole for the 2020s. Good defensively, but his bat has kind of tailed off somewhat. He's a rental. So they had players like that where it's like, okay, you're going to get something back, but none of these were the I'm trading Mason Miller and, oh, let's see, you know, how, but which is also okay, because the players that the Orioles traded, if they can't replace that with the other guys that they have there, then it is a failure of something much more significant. Because like Ryan O'Hearn, if Kobe Mayo can't take that job, that's a real problem, because that job, Kobe Mayo has been waiting for that job for a long time now. If Heston Kjerstad can't find a role, guys like that, that's a problem, right? Like, they need some of these guys to step up because they've been waiting for this for a long time.
All right, gentlemen, I got one more thing for you. That's all for our fan questions. Before we get out of here, though, I want your biggest team winner of the trade deadline. Jeff, we're gonna put you on the spot first.
Oh man, now I'm like trying to scour the trade.
I got one.
So while you're figuring that out, JJ, go for it. Yep,
go ahead.
I started this by saying this. I'm not saying there are our teams who may have done better, but for the amount that they gave up and for the difference it should make for their team, Seattle, because I don't think Seattle gave up anyone. They gave up some relievers who are going to be good relievers in the big leagues, but I don't think they gave up anyone that they're going to be sitting there shaking their head going, what were we thinking? And if they don't get help from what they added, it would stun me, because, you know, Caleb Ferguson they've added a little depth to the pen. But Eugenio Suarez has hit almost double the number of homers as anyone on that team has hit other than Cal Raleigh. And Josh Naylor, I know he hasn't hit for as much power this year, but Josh Naylor is a much better first base bat than what they were playing before. It's two key additions. There's a lot of teams that did more than that, but I just feel like that they were so needing this, that especially at the low cost of what they paid.
That was my pick. Jeff, what do you got?
Yeah, I think that's probably the number one ranked team. We take a look at all the teams that are out there, but you know, I don't know. I'm between a couple, because you know, I do think the Orioles did a good job of trading off Cedric Mullins and some of these other pieces, and you know, getting some good value. And between that and you know, some of the trades they made before the draft that then allowed them to have the bonus pool that they had, they've really done a good job of rebuilding this farm system kind of on the fly. Maybe lack some of the high-end guys that they had in years past, but you know, that will happen when you're not drafting at, you know, the top, you know, 2 to 3 picks in a draft or number one year after year. I think the Mets have to be considered a winner as well, going out there and, you know, acquiring a bunch of really good bullpen pieces. That was, you know, definitely a flaw for that team and potentially an Achilles heel when the playoffs came around. Now they have some options. Even if something would happen to Edwin Diaz, they kind of have a closer in waiting in Helsley. And then, you know, the acquisition of Rogers that we talked about, I thought they did a really good job without having to trade any of that kind of future core or some of the really good prospects at the top of their system. They kind of did the same thing as the Mariners, just maybe on a different scale and kind of went after different positions. But I also think adding Cedric Mullins certainly helps them a lot and probably was a better buy, especially if you're a playoff team, than Louis Robert was.
Well, that's going to do it for the Baseball America Trade Deadline Palooza. We thank you for tuning in and all of your great questions. Before we let you go, I would encourage you to head on over to baseballamerica.com to check out tons of great trade deadline content. We've been breaking down every trade. We're ranking the prospects that have been on the move and a whole lot more. So make sure you go out and check that out over at baseballamerica.com. For Jeff Ponce, JJ Cooper, I'm Jacob Rudner, and we will see you next time.